can I just get started, please? In the middle of the Spanish Civil War, about which I'll say more in a moment, but the dates of it are 1936 to 39, George Orwell was quite seriously wounded and was on his way home to England. On his way, he discovered that one of the officers under whom he'd been serving had been taken prisoner. The captors of that officer were not, though, the right-wing troops against which they had been fighting, but the government itself, the Republican government, which was trying to defend itself, an elected Republican government, trying to defend itself against an armed military coup led by, in the end, by General Franco, who became dictator. Now, Orwell was one of the first people to point out, inside or outside Spain, that this, that the Republicans, by which I don't mean what they mean in the USA, but people who wanted to do away with monarchy and to have a republic, were increasingly behaving in the Spanish Civil War as if they were an outpost of Stalin's Russia. One of the complicating factors about the Spanish Civil War, which was a kind of dress rehearsal, even Act One, of the Second World War, was that German Nazis and Italian fascists came in behind General Franco immediately with arms and troops and moral support and financial support. And almost to stem that tide, the Soviet Union came in behind the Republic. But the Soviet Union exacted its own terms and made its own hideous standards. And at this time, there was nothing really to choose, morally, politically, between Stalin's Russia and Hitler's Germany. So it was the Republicans who arrested this officer. While the army, the Republican army, very divided in different factions, was fighting for the elected government, the government itself was quietly imprisoning and executing key members of a particular faction of the Republic. That faction was called the Partido Obrero de Unificación Marxista, the Workers' Party of Marxist Unification. Sounds very long and elaborate, but the Marxists were despised by the Stalinists, and the Stalinists wanted to do away with them. Marxism was, if you like, a sort of purer version of communism, something closer to what we know as socialism, though not nearly as democratic. I'll now get on to a sort of slightly simpler version of this, which is the graphic aspect of it. Like everyone else who was arrested then or later during the Spanish Civil War or under the dictatorship, the officer, whose name was Kopp, K-O-P-P, wasn't told why he'd been imprisoned, and all his papers were taken off him by the police, so he became immediately a non-person. You imagine to yourself, in any situation, suddenly being without not only your credit cards, but your passport, and your address book, and everything that establishes who you are, and then somebody saying, I don't believe you are who you are. That was his situation. And among these papers he had was a letter from the Ministry of War, the government Ministry of War, which made clear that he was a key military commander on the Republican side, on the side of the government. Now, Orwell managed to visit him in prison. And, of course, he realized the importance of this document. And so he decided to try and get it back from the police. And this narrative is on the first page of the handout, of which there are some more copies down here, if anybody needs one. He says, I saw instantly how important this letter might be. That's the second paragraph. An official letter of that kind, bearing the recommendation of the Ministry of the War and of General Pothas, would establish Kopp's bona fides, that he was a good bloke. But the trouble was to prove that the letter existed. If it were opened in the chief of police's office, one could be sure that some narc or other would destroy it. There was only one person who might possibly be able to get it back, and that was the officer to whom it was addressed. Kopp had already thought of this, and he had written a letter which he wanted me to smuggle out of the jail and post, but it was obviously quicker and surer to go in person. I left my wife with Cop, rushed out, and after a long search, found a taxi. I knew that time was everything. It was now about 5:30. The colonel would probably leave his office at 6, and by tomorrow the letter might be God knew where, destroyed perhaps, or lost somewhere in the chaos of documents that was presumably piling up as suspect after suspect was arrested. The colonel's office was at the War Department, down by the quay. As I hurried up the steps, the assault guard on duty at the door barred the way with his long bayonet and demanded papers. I waved my discharge ticket at him. Evidently, he could not read, and he let me pass, impressed by the vague mystery of papers. Inside, the place was a huge, complicated warren running round a central courtyard with hundreds of offices on each floor, and as this was Spain, nobody had the vaguest idea where the office I was looking for was. I kept repeating, El coronel, jefe de ingenieros, ejército de este, chief of engineers, army of the east. People smiled and shrugged their shoulders gracefully. Everyone who had an opinion sent me in a different direction, up these stairs, down those, along interminable passages which turned out to be blind alleys, and time was slipping away. I had the strangest sensation of being in a nightmare, the rushing up and down flights of stairs, the mysterious people coming and going, the glimpses through open doors of chaotic offices with papers strewn everywhere and typewriters clicking and time slipping away and a life, perhaps, in the balance. Now, it could easily be Kafka, couldn't it? Especially if you've read Kafka's novel, The Trial. And later, Orwell did write two of the most Kafkaesque of British novels, Animal Farm, 1945, and 1984, which was published in 1949. But the passage I've just read, which is from Homage to Catalonia, and these titles are on the back of the handout somewhere, I hope. That book is not fiction. And among Orwell's reasons for writing it was precisely a fear that fiction, in the form of propaganda, would come to overwhelm truth. As he wrote later, and again, this is on the handout, but I haven't paginated it very well. It's on the back of the handout, actually. This is in an essay that I hope you will have read called Looking Back on the Spanish War. He said it will never be possible to get a completely accurate and unbiased account of the Barcelona fighting because the necessary records do not exist. Future historians will have nothing to go upon except a mass of accusations and party propaganda. I myself have little data beyond what I saw with my own eyes and what I have learned from other eyewitnesses whom I believe to be reliable. This kind of thing is frightening to me because it often gives me the feeling that the very concept of objective truth is fading out of the world. After all, the chances are that those lies, or at any rate similar lies, will pass into history. The implied objective of this line of thought is a nightmare world, again a nightmare world, in which the leader, or some ruling clique, controls not only the future, but the past. If the leader says of such and such an event, it never happened, well, it never happened. If he says that 2 and 2 are 5, well, 2 and 2 are 5. Now, there's a lot to think about in that statement, about how history is written, about the evidence on which history is based, on the susceptibility of history to manipulation by the victorious or the powerful side. It's often said that history is the victor's story, that the vanquished don't get to tell their version, though that tends to have proved to be the opposite in the case of the Spanish Civil War. It also reminds us, I say this in parentheses, but you may want to think about it tomorrow or in these days in your seminars, why inquiries like the Chilcot one about the beginning of the Iraq War are so important and why democracies have such inquiries. A lot of people are saying, well, we've already had X inquiries into the Iraq War. We all know that Tony Blair was lying about the evidence on which the Parliament was persuaded to go to war. But in a sense, we can't go on hearing that too much, and it is terribly important to us that we should hear some of the bits that we haven't heard before. For example, that Jack Straw wrote to the Prime Minister and said, look, this is illegal, and it's not a good idea beforehand. If you live under a dictatorship or under a totalitarian regime, these pieces of evidence are destroyed and such inquiries are not allowed. So it's important to remember, however fumbling that inquiry is and however little it can do about, nothing it can do about what happened in the past, that at least it enables us to get a truthful account as near as possible of what happened. Now, of course, all art, including fiction, claims to be more true in a way than received versions of the truth. But such claims are particularly strong in times when propaganda and mythology are dominant, and wars are such times and such situations. You've only got to think about the power of that idea that in the case of the Iraq War, there are still plenty of people who believe, and Sarah Palin said it in her campaign in the last American election, that it was Al-Qaeda that Iraq and Al-Qaeda were in cahoots, and that's why it was important to bring down Iraq, for example. And both sides were saying there are these weapons of mass destruction. Nobody's found them, but there are. So when you're getting propaganda like this, truth becomes particularly important. And the poet, the American poet Wallace Stevens, said something very important about this, about the relationship of literature to war. It's on the first page of the handout. He says, "The immense poetry of war and the poetry of a work of the imagination are two different things. In the presence of the violent reality of war, consciousness takes the place of the imagination, and consciousness of an immense war is a consciousness of fact." In other words, if you're in a war, you don't want fiction, you don't need fiction. It's big enough, it's exciting enough, it's terrifying enough without fiction. What you want is the truth. That's the difficult bit to find. So I want to talk now a little bit about this particular aspect in relation to Orwell's work. I'll be focusing to start with on Homage to Catalonia, which I know that you haven't been asked to read, and probably hardly any of you have read, if any. But then I'll turn to the essays. There's a direct connection between the two. A bit of background. At one level, this dichotomy between fact and poetry, a dichotomy come merging, was straightforward enough, particularly in the years leading up to the Second World War. In the 1930s and 40s, writers became deeply interested in the imaginative power of fact itself. In the visual arts, there's an equivalent in what's called objet trouvé, found objects, and in its extension, the collage, made up of bits of newspapers, bits of buttons, anything you happen to find. And we've already spoken about William Carlos Williams as a kind of precursor of this. So much depends on a red wheelbarrow because it's a red wheelbarrow. It's the red wheelbarrow-ness of the red wheelbarrow that is important. Now, it might seem that an easy next step from that would be to forget about, even to reject altogether, aestheticism. That's to say, to forget about whether a work is beautiful or enjoyable and to focus solely on whether it's factually true. And there have been people who have followed that argument, but not necessarily as clearly as they thought they were doing. On the second page of the handout, I've given you a poem about the Second World War by a Scottish writer called, that first name is pronounced Riven, though it looks like Ruthven, Riven Todd. He was educated in an art school, Edinburgh Art School. And he was a farm labourer. And like many writers in the 1930s and 40s, his concern was with ordinary people, the impact of world events on ordinary people, doing away with the kind of elitist view of art. And his particular subject in this poem, is a footnote which explains this, is the kind of propaganda use that was made in the Second World War in Britain of the fact that St. Paul's Cathedral survived the Blitz. Day after day in the newspapers, you'd see these pictures of St. Paul's surrounded by dust and rubble, And there it was, and people said, you know, this is a beacon of survival. It's an emblem of British endurance. And the idea was that this gave people hope. And there was a massive air raid, as you see there, on the 29th of December 1940, in the Big Blitz, as they called it, the first part or the worst part of the Blitz, when there was huge devastation all around St. Paul's. And one of the reasons why there are endless planning discussions about St. Paul's and, you know, what should we put here, what should we do there, can we knock this office block down, do that, is precisely that so little around the church, around the cathedral, survived. So it was rebuilt afterwards very badly, and then people said, this is terrible, knock it down again, build something else. Never quite resolved. Anyway, Riventodd is fed up with the propaganda about St. Paul's Cathedral. These are facts, he begins, very importantly. These are facts. Observe them how you will. Forget for a moment the medals and the glory, the clean shape of the bomb designed to kill, and the proud headlines of the paper's story. Remember the walls of brick that 40 years had nursed to make a neat though shabby home. The impertinence of death, ignoring tears that smashed the house and left untouched the dome. Bodies in death are not magnificent or stately. Bones are not elegant that blast has shattered. This sorry, stained, and crumpled rag was lately a man whose life was made of little things that mattered. Now he's just a nuisance, liable to stink, a breeding ground for flies, a test tube for disease. Bury him quickly, and never pause to think, what is the future worth to men like these? People are more than places, more than pride. A million photographs record the works of Wren. A city remains a city on credit from the tide that flows among its rocks, a sea of men. The argument is perfectly clear and explicit. I don't need to try to paraphrase it. But the paradox I want to point out is that Riventodd in the poem is saying that the aesthetics of, I hope that wasn't my phone, the aesthetics of St. Paul's Cathedral are irrelevant beside the lives of the ordinary people of the East End living around the docks, which is why that area was bombed so much. And he uses a particularly 1930s idea. A million photographs record the works of Wren. So, you know, who cares about the actual cathedral? We know what it looked like. We've got all these pictures of it. And yet, implicitly, indeed explicitly, saying human people, human beings are more important than art, he is, of course, writing something which is rather traditionally a work of art. It's not. It's a very simple and powerful, deeply felt poem, but nobody would claim for it that it's an outstanding art object as a piece of invention or structure or use of language. What it is something as traditional as Wren's Cathedral, if you like, in stanzas rhyming ABAB with a strict rhythm. In other words, one of the dilemmas of literature in literature of fact is that literature can never successfully ignore the aesthetic. And George Orwell was quite explicit about this and wrote about it often, as you know, in his essays. There's one particular passage which I think is on page 2, the top of page 2 of the handout. Every line of serious work that I've written since 1936, the beginning of the Spanish Civil War, has been written directly or indirectly against totalitarianism and for democratic socialism as I understand it. It seems to me nonsense in a period like our own to think that one can avoid writing of such subjects. Everyone writes of them in one guise or another. It is simply a question of which side one takes and what approach one follows. What I've most wanted to do throughout the past 10 years is to make political writing into an art. My starting point is always a feeling of partisanship, a sense of injustice, but I could not do the work of writing a book or even a long magazine article if it were not also an aesthetic experience. Very important, that, the idea of a long magazine article as an aesthetic experience. Now, whatever I say later in this short lecture, it's important to bear in mind that Orwell always knew that there could be good art, forgive these rather crude simplifications, about bad subjects, and good art by bad people, and vice versa in both cases. I'm going to raise what I think is a very complicated issue concerning this in relation to Irene Nemirovsky next week. I'm going to try to suggest that, I won't tell you now what I'm going to try to suggest, but it's relevant. Much of the literary criticism Orwell wrote was about people who either didn't care about politics or were, in his own terms, on the wrong side. Kipling, P.G. Wodehouse, who stayed in France, occupied France during the Second World War and did broadcasts for on behalf of the Nazis, not because he was a Nazi, but because he was an idiot. Henry Miller. Much of what he wrote in literary criticism was a defense of individuality in art against the conformist pressures of what we would now call political correctness. Being on the right side, telling the truth, matter a lot, but Orwell repeatedly shows and insists they aren't all that matters. Now, to return very briefly to Riven Todd, poetry in the literal sense, I know that George Tooley was talking last week about war poetry from many countries and in different wars, and implicitly reminding us that war is a kind of permanent condition of life, as has often been said, that it's not that, you know, the world is at peace, we just happen not to have one going on our own shores at the moment. But poetry isn't what we associate most with the Second World War. And indeed, in the Second World War, many literary types kept asking the question, where are the war poets? Because they were thinking about the First World War, which of course had produced famously poets like Wilfred Owen and Siegfried Sassoon. Everybody thought, well, this must be a natural thing to come out of war, particularly protest poetry. Now, there were some good Second World War poets. Of British writers, I would mention Alan Lewis, Henry Reed, Keith Douglas. Of Americans, Randall Jarrell, Richard Eberhardt. But actually what has most defined and described and brought home to us imaginatively Second World War have been movies and novels and factual accounts. One of the reasons for this is the straightforward fact that artists are bound to use new technology. That's why the movies are so important in this. Another is that they don't want to do what's been done before, and the very fact that the First World War had, had its poets made that a less interesting thing to do. There's no point in writing a Wilfred Owen poem about the Second World War because we'd already had such poems. But there's also this movement that I've already mentioned in passing, this interest in fact and factual observation and the kind of poetry that fact produced. This was the age, for example, of something called mass observation in Great Britain, and I've given you a little copy on the back page of of one of the covers of those mass observation reports. Mass observation basically consisted of getting people to record absolutely ordinary people, anybody you could come across. We're used to it now, the sort of vox pop idea, people going, sticking a microphone under people's noses and saying, you know, how upsetting was this? And then they have to say, very upsetting, you know. But actually, these guys were a bit more interesting than that. They actually got people to write down in more detail what they thought and what they experienced. These guys being two people, two socialists, called Charles Madge and Thomas Harrison. They were pioneering what they called the science of ourselves. They were pioneering sociology, in fact. And Madge was a poet as well as a sociologist. He was published by Faber, by T.S. Eliot, who was, as you know, an editor at Faber and Faber, the poetry editor. And the other was, as I say, Thomas Harrison, who was an anthropologist by training. Anthropologists traditionally described the customs and life habits of people in remote cultures. And it was a new idea then that you could actually look at people close to yourselves and think about them, particularly people under difficult circumstances like a war, and and that that was a valuable thing to do. Interestingly, both men came from privileged backgrounds. Madge had been to Winchester College, and Harrison had been to Harrow. They had in common then with Henry Green, and also with Orwell, who we're talking about now, who was a contemporary of Henry Green's at Eton, a sense of class guilt, and also a sense, an intense curiosity about a world which their upbringing had separated them from. This, I don't think, was patronizing, though it obviously has all kinds of uncomfortable aspects about it. It was genuinely curious and genuinely philanthropic in impulse. Orwell himself conducted some important experiments in crossing class boundaries and in writing literature of fact in the 1930s. Let me tell you a little bit about him. He was born in 1903, and I'll suggest the relevance of that in a moment. And for a long time he was best known, and perhaps you yourselves know him best, as the author of those allegories of totalitarianism, which I've already mentioned, Animal Farm and 1984. And fiction was always an important part of his work. He started out as a novelist with, for example, Burmese Days, 1935, which was based on 5 years which he spent in the colonial police force in Burma. British rules, Burma. That was immediately after he left school. And that's the period he recalls in his essay, Shooting an Elephant, which I hope you've read. Now, his achievement in those novels and in his other writing was much more to do with his political analysis of the real world, his bringing to life what the class relations and the power relations were of people in the real world than anything more fully imaginative, it seems to me. Even at its most fantastical seeming, as in Animal Farm in 1984, what he's writing is an extrapolation from what he'd experienced, not least in the Britain of the war, which was the Britain of censorship and of propaganda. Orwell worked both for the BBC and for the Ministry of Information, which was, of course, really the Ministry of Propaganda, and which he satirized in 1984 as the Ministry of Truth, which was abbreviated as Mini-True, which also, of course, suggests a minimum of truth and possibly a maximum of falsehood. And even the title, 1984, is famously just the year in which he wrote the book, 1948, turned around a bit. It's arguable, I think it's probably the case, that his most important works are actually his more directly factual and or polemical ones, his overtly non-fictional ones. I'm referring to, and again these titles are on the back of the handout, Down and Out in Paris and London, The Road to Wigan Pier, and Homage to Catalonia, as well as his essays, which I'll be coming onto in a moment. In Down and Out in Paris and London and The Road to Wigan Pier, Orwell did a kind of personal experiment in mass observation. Instead of going up to people all the time and asking them what they thought about this and that or what their experience of this and that was, he actually tried out those experiences. What is it like to live in a doss house? What is it like to look for accommodation with no money? What is it like to work as the poorest paid kind of worker in a hotel in Paris? And those are the things he described. How do people die, and what happens to them when they die if they've got no money? Much of his work then, just as I was saying that anthropology moved from remote locations to home and became social sociology, social studies, so Orwell took what he saw of colonialism and the power structures of colonialism in Burma and came home and thought, well, is this all that different from that, really? A question one would hope perhaps to ask of the people on the cruise ship in Haiti who went and swam and sat on the beach a few miles from where people were being dragged out from bodies in these last days. Some of them said how awful they felt, and they wouldn't get off the cruise ship because they knew what was happening in Haiti. But what difference does it make? They were on the cruise ship, where perhaps they should think to themselves, and perhaps we should think about what is expressed by that, irrespective of whether they got off and swam. That's the kind of question that Orwell would certainly have written an essay about, and certainly was preoccupied with. What is power in practice? And you see it in a hanging, and you see it in shooting an elephant, and you also see it in Homage to Catalonia. Now, what he was doing in Spain was literally, again, you know, he believed that both as a writer and as a human being, the thing was to actually do what you thought needed to be done, not to watch other people doing it or urge other people to do it. There are different arguments about that question. I'm not suggesting it's a recipe for everybody. Not everybody would be very good at doing some of the things they want other people to do. It may be better that others do them. But this was Orwell's impulse in general. And he was one of the many non-Spanish volunteers from the USA, from Britain, from France, from Germany, who signed up to fight for the Republic in Spain, the elected Republic, and against the extreme right-wing uprising. Now, you will know that some of these people were writers and artists like Orwell. Among the British, the first English volunteer to be killed in the Spanish Civil War, the first English person who'd signed up for what were called the International Brigades, was a woman painter, Felicia Brown, she was called, with an E at the end of her name, Felicia Brown. The poet John Cornford, quite a good poet, was killed in the Battle for Madrid. Stephen Spender wrote propaganda for the Republicans. And if you're thinking about Americans, very famously, Ernest Hemingway went and wrote about Spain. John Dos Passos also wrote, possibly rather better than Hemingway, but has been more forgotten than Hemingway. Martha Gellhorn, American journalist who was married for a while to Hemingway, was there writing about it and continued to write about it. I could go on with a long list of the writers and artists, particularly writers who took part. But it's important to remember that most members of the International Brigades were not members of the social elite or the cultural elite. They were working people. Some of them had gone because they didn't have jobs and you could get some money fighting in the International Brigades, but you were also fighting on a side you believed in, which was for the working class, and quite a lot of them were trade unionists. Now, as far as different people were concerned, a lot of different motives were involved. Most of them were good political motives. One was a kind of internationalism. The International Brigades was a straightforward description, but also a very powerfully evocative one. Remember, it's not so long since the Russian Revolution, and if it was true that all human beings were brothers and sisters, then it made sense that if there was a battle going on between working people and rich people anywhere in the world, that you had a stake in that, and your view had to be international, just as your song was the international. And so you would go and take part. And idealism of that kind was a very important impulse in all this, and in Orwell's wish to go. Of course, there were other reasons, individual adventurism or just adventurousness. And part of that was in the case of the upper-class people who went to class guilt. By the way, I should say that there were volunteers on both sides. There were writers and artists and ordinary people who fought on the nationalist side for General Franco because they believed in that. And there was another aspect, psychological aspect, I think, that affected people like Orwell. And that was that a lot of the people who went and volunteered had been at school during the First World War, which was a very peculiar place to be in every sense, but particularly because every day you got these lists of people, or every week or every month, lists of people who had been at the school, who had been killed. And you felt not very obscurely embarrassed and guilty that you weren't there, that perhaps these older people who you might have known at the school when you were just there and they were just leaving, or perhaps they were your brothers or your cousins, were involved in this. And then came 1918, and you, if you were Orwell, were 15, and you weren't going to get your chance after all. And I think quite a lot of the people who went to Spain did so feeling that they had to show that they were brave enough to do that if their friends and people they'd been conscious of had been brave enough in the First World War, they were too. So he had all those reasons to take part. But the simplest and the strongest and the most important for him, as for so many other people, was that he wanted to help defeat fascism. Now, Spanish nationalism was can't be exactly and perfectly mapped onto either Italian fascism or German Nazism, but it's close enough to do. And I'm not going to get involved in a sort of complicated argument about whether Franco's behavior is somehow redeemed by the fact that he wasn't quite the same as Hitler. And certainly Orwell regarded the nationalists as fascists, and many of the nationalists themselves called themselves fascists. So what Orwell said explicitly in homage to Catalonia is, when I joined the militia, I had promised myself to kill one fascist. After all, he said, this sort of wonderful, sort of plain common sense of Orwell, if each of us, the Republicans, killed one, they would soon be extinct. Now, Orwell's such a good writer, and he's so much on the right side, so often morally and intellectually, that you have to sort of think about what he says sometimes and say, is this okay or not? You know, he's making it sound okay, but is it? And he does sometimes sound like the colonialist he once was, out to bag a few tigers. You know, I'm going to kill a fascist. You can imagine him wanting to sort of stuff it and bring it home in his trunk. But his essential willingness to face harsh facts about war was important then and important subsequently when he lived as a writer during the Second World War. Now, I began with the idea that literature of war is at bottom literature of fact. And I'll show briefly in a moment that much of what Orwell wrote fits that description. But Homage to Catalonia, like Orwell's essays, is also literature of analysis and of argument. The chapters which describe life at the front, which are extraordinarily vivid and all the time determined to record what Orwell himself experienced, irrespective of whether it's what he feels he ought to have experienced, are intercalated with chapters which are trying to describe the very complicated political divisions involved in Spain, to explain to British readers that this was not straightforwardly a battle of left against right, because the right was so internally divided and the left was so internally divided. So, for example, the parties which tried to unite on the Republican side included the Soviet-backed communists of this party, Partido Socialista Unificado de Catalunya, the disaffiliated Marxists opposed to Stalin of the Partido Obrero de Unificación Marxista that I've told you about, a conglomerate of trade unions, this National Confederation of Workers, and the group in some ways hardest to assimilate, the anarchists, the Federación Anarquista de Iberia, who believed in individual liberty and doing exactly what you liked and not obeying orders, which is a very difficult body of people to assimilate into an army. Now, these and other contending factions were all on the Republican side, and there were similar divisions among their enemies. And Orwell is unusual among war writers in concerning himself closely with and taking sides in the details of the political and ideological issues concerned. And I think that what part of that is about is his resistance to simplification. Although he's famously a writer who writes plainly and simply and tries to tell things in an understandable way, he didn't want to be part of any propaganda thing. And so that meant that he had to say, look, this is a very, very, very complicated war. However, having said all that, a main reason for reading Homage to Catalonia is its graphic and plain and unsentimental account of day-to-day life in combat. Facts such as that ambulances were shelled by both sides, even if they had red crosses on them, justifiably, Orwell says, for in modern war, no one scruples to use an ambulance to carry ammunition. Or when he says, when an aeroplane swoops down and uses its machine gun, the sound from below is like the fluttering of wings. Or that when you are watching artillery fire from a safe distance, you always want the gunner to hit his mark, even though the mark contains your dinner and some of your comrades. It's an extraordinary idea. Think of Orwell watching the nationalist guns lining up against the Republicans and actually hitting his own side and thinking, good shot. As I say, he's all the time trying to resist propaganda and resist the wished for rather than the truth. This is a bit like Colin Tobin, for those of you who heard him the other day. I think it was afterwards, not during his reading, that he was talking about Irish neutrality in the Second World War and the fact that Irish people will say, you know, well, at least we kept out of the Second World War. And he said, well, I sometimes say to these people, that's the Second World War you're talking about, is it? Yeah, at least we stayed out of the Second World War. And he said, oh, yeah. So that was the one that was about the Nazis wanting to establish a world dictatorship and to kill all the Jews and gypsies and maimed people. That's the one you're talking about. Yeah. And so that was a good idea. We stayed out of that. Ah, I hadn't thought of that. I must think about that. Anyway, he's apparently going to write a big piece about Irish neutrality in which he hopes to shake his countrymen out of their complacency on that issue. And that was it's a very Orwellian position to take. And Tobin is in some ways, in his non-fiction, a very Orwellian writer. Now, I'm not going to go on talking about Homage to Catalonia. I hope I've said enough to persuade you that you should, if you like these essays, that you should read it. But I will turn now to the essays. Much of his work began, as I've already suggested, as journalism, whether as reportage or as argument, the idea of the art of a magazine article. And then a lot of those essays were extended and adapted and went into subsequent books. For example, an essay called The Spike, which is about his experiences of the temporary accommodation for homeless men, went into Down and Out in Paris and London. So there's that journalistic opportunism of reworking pieces and using them in different contexts. It's also important that his essays include a lot of serious literary criticism which is engaged in aesthetic as well as social and political matters. And from your point of view, you'll be interested in his comments on high modernism, both in his 1943 essay on Yeats and a little earlier in Inside the Whale, where he tackles head-on the question that we're all the time thinking about in this module, which is about the relation and lack of it between good writing and direct political engagement. There's this wonderful passage, which is on the third page of the Xerox, which you might want to discuss, where he's been talking about Elias and Joyce and others. And he says, what's noticeable, this is bottom right-hand corner of page 3, what is noticeable about all these writers is that what purpose they have is very much up in the air. There's no attention to the urgent problems of the moment. Above all, no politics in the narrower sense. Our eyes are directed to Rome, to Byzantium, to Montparnasse, to the subconscious, to the solar plexus, to everything except the places where things are actually happening. When one looks back at the 20s, nothing is queerer than the way in which every important event in Europe escaped the notice of the English intelligentsia, by which he also includes the Irish. The Russian Revolution, for instance, all but vanishes from the English consciousness between the death of Lenin in 1924 and the Ukraine famine, about 10 years. Throughout those years, Russia means Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, and exiled counts driving taxicabs. Italy means picture galleries, ruins, churches, and museums, but not black shirts. Germany means films, nudism, and psychoanalysis, but not Hitler, of whom hardly anyone had heard till 1931. In cultured circles, which he puts in inverted commas, cultured circles, art for art's sake extended practically to a worship of the meaningless. Literature was supposed to consist only in the meaning of words. Now, all this is energetic and readable, and it's certainly very enjoyable to debate. It's also true up to a point. But Orwell, the journalist, it seems to me, just to give the most obvious response to what he's saying, is forgetting that it can take quite a while for writers to gestate external events and work them into their writing. Dickens is A Tale of Two Cities, for example, is about the French Revolution, but it appeared 70 years later, in 1859. War and Peace appeared in 1865 to 72, more than half a century after Napoleon's invasion of Russia, which is the war in question in War and Peace. And similarly, as for Mussolini and Hitler, contemporary fiction is still struggling with them and trying to deal with them. One of Philip Roth's recent novels, just to take one example, is set in a USA which has decided to take the Nazi side in the Second World War. Tarantino's movie, Inglourious Basterds, last year, is about the Second World War. A.L. Kennedy, who teaches here, her novel Day is about somebody who chooses to be a rear gunner in the Second World War. It's very interesting to reflect upon what it is these people who didn't live through those events are doing. And to remember that in all the connections between journalism and literature, between literature and the modern world, one can't expect instant results. These engagements take time. Now, if Orwell mistakes literature for journalism in terms of requirements like deadlines and contemporaneity, so too his criteria included the kind of directness, which he himself turned into one kind of art, but it's not the only kind of art. He has little time for the oblique ways in which current events seeped into the wasteland, for example. But his piece is journalism, and it was published in 1940 and imbued with a high cultural version of the slightly helpless, demotic spirit, which became known as the Blitz spirit. And it has a terrific quality of driving the reader forward, an extraordinary range of reference, which never comes across as showing off or as literary, and a determination to mock his own side as much as his opponent's. So, for example, he describes the left-wing literary climate of the 1930s as a sort of Boy Scout atmosphere of bare knees and community singing, and also an ability to drop in viscerally well-targeted phrases which will be quoted and requoted for decades afterwards. For example, picking on Auden's line about, in his poem Spain, line about the necessary murder, a line which Auden doubtless piqued by what Orwell said and recognizing the truth of it subsequently changed. Auden said, "Mr. Auden's brand of amoralism is only possible if you are the kind of person who is always somewhere else when the trigger is fired." Now, above all, Orwell in these essays is important in opening up the range of what could be written about seriously. I'm not only thinking of those prophetic late novels, but of the huge range of interests he pursues in the essays and the way in which they anticipate later intellectual developments and academic developments. Cultural studies, for example, in his essays on boys' comics, Donald McGill's postcards, English cooking, best-selling fiction, sport. He's also one of the founders, and I've given some reasons for saying this, of literary post-colonialism. And again, that essay, Shooting an Elephant, or Marrakesh, or the third section of The Lion and the Unicorn, will give you examples of that. In The Lion and the Unicorn, he dares to suggest that in concentrating on improving the material conditions of British working people, the trade unions closed their eyes to the fact that British prosperity, this is a quotation, depended indirectly on the sweating of Indian coolies. Now, from the point of view of writing about war, which is our topic in these weeks, the essays are valuable in several ways, and I'll end here. One is that Orwell understood and mounted an intelligent defense of patriotism. Whatever your views of war, you won't get close to an understanding of it if you ignore that sentiment. He also writes brilliantly about the terrifying vulnerability of history to propaganda, as in that essay I quoted earlier. And he distilled one of the essential and most disturbing paradoxes of all war, which is that it applies the most sophisticated inventions of the human mind to the most brutal ends. He doesn't talk, as far as I remember, about the paradox that so many of the technological developments that we depend on and enjoy owe their main impetus to, their primary impetus to, the development of weapons to kill other people. But what he does say at the very beginning of his essay, England, Your England, written in December 1940, published in December 1940, so possibly written the month before, that exactly the time that Riven Todd is writing about in that poem, These Are Facts. He says, as I write, highly civilized human beings are flying overhead trying to kill me. Highly civilized human beings are flying overhead trying to kill me. That recognition that the enemy, the people on the other side, are not distinguishable from himself or from his readers in terms of human value and the attainments that peaceful civilizations strive for and bellicose civilizations claim to be defending, that the people on the other side are as valuable as he is and as we are. Okay, I'll leave it there. Thank you very much.